corner?
Same one.
Yep.
We distributed the.
Distributed the wealth.
Judicial Committee.
Aggregation of resources.
Back in session. We're back with Senator Limmer at House File 460. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've heard the testimony, and if there's any questions by members, I'll be more than happy to answer them.
Hey, Senator Limmer, I believe we have a few more testifiers.
Oh, we do. Okay.
Are there others that would like to testify that are on the list first? Please come up and take one of the two chairs, sir.
He should have brought him up. That's what I redistributed. Two Newman and
now three chairs.
So now I just thought maybe he should have.
Is there anybody else here that would like to testify? Okay. If a couple of you want to come up then to the other chairs. And may I remind everyone that testimony should be about 3 minutes. They've gone over quite a bit, and that's why we're here this evening. So let's try to stick to that if we can, and let's try not to be redundant with what other people have spoken on. Thank you. Please identify yourself and then continue with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Bob Dahm. I'm the Chief Deputy State Fire Marshal in the Department of Public Safety. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House File 460 on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Our opposition is based on the state's nearly four decades of experience in adopting state billing and fire codes through the rulemaking process. This bill prevents us from dealing with an available critical life safety strategy in our codes, one known to save lives, property, and the environment. The Departments of Public Safety and Labor and Industry jointly prepare our state's building and fire code updates for adoption through the rulemaking process with the goal of ensuring that our citizens and visitors enjoy a reasonable degree of protection from fire. The rulemaking process put into a place by the legislature is a very lengthy process which needs and is designed to allow diverse opinions into the discussion. The goal is a consensus document. When that is not possible, hearings are held and an administrative law judge determines the outcome. The residential sprinkler requirement under scrutiny here is found in a national model code known as the International Residential Code. Minnesota uses these code models as a basis for designing our state codes. Then, during a thorough review process, we make amendments to the model code to fit Minnesota. We can't start our review process for the new codes until the spring of 2011. When the 2012 edition is in print. At that point, advisory committees would be formed and meetings will be held with all interested parties. The review process for a new edition of the state codes typically takes 18 months. The likely effective date of the new code is spring of 2013. The Department of Public Safety encourages the opponents of residential sprinklers to engage in this lengthy review process. That is where discussions should take place on water supplies, fire alarms, fire department connections, maintenance, sprinklering fish houses and seasonal properties, all issues which aren't required in the model code or won't be required in the final version of the Minnesota code because discussions have taken place in rulemaking process and reasonable people have come to agreement. There are entirely too many TV shows and movies that would have you believe you can pull a fire alarm and the sprinklers go off and or when one sprinkler head goes off, they all do. It makes for good TV, but it distorts the true operation of this life-saving technology. With regard to the need for fire sprinklers, I have two major life safety and firefighter safety concerns about the homes being built today. One is what is referred to as lightweight construction. Full-scale fire tests done by independent firms have shown collapse in 10 minutes in this type of construction. The second is the combustibility of materials we put into the home environment, mostly plastic. The tenability or survivability time in a home fire has dropped from 17-plus minutes in 1975 to 3 minutes now, based on a study conducted by the U.S. Department of Commerce, National Institute of Standards and Technology. This bill prevents us from dealing with an available critical life safety strategy in our codes, one known to save lives, property, and the environment. Mr. Chairman, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Dahm. Any questions for Mr. Dahm? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, I'm sorry, Senator Latz.
Thank you. Sir, do you know, are there any other instances in which
The legislature has specified an outcome or a provision in statute that might ordinarily be handled through the rulemaking process for the state building code.
Chief Down.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, yes, I am aware of a couple of provisions. Some of them have to do with provisions for the licensure of various kinds of daycare facilities in the Department of Human Services. Those issues have been problematic for us in terms of enforcing the state fire code in certain circumstances. And I'm sure there are others, Senator, but I'm sorry that I just can't bring them to mind right at this particular moment. But that one does come into mind where provisions have been placed into statute that proved problematic for us.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I don't know if there's anyone else in the room when the opportunity arises who can help us understand if there are other places in statute where we have basically determined the outcome of what otherwise would have been a rulemaking process and placed it in statute. I'm just trying to get my arms around the process issue.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I will be happy to go back and talk with our code staff and provide you with some of those at the first convenience tomorrow.
Thank you, Chief Town. Sir?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Dan Winkle. I'm the fire chief for the city of Andover. And I'm here today representing the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. It's 15,000 members, and I'll also be speaking for the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs. President Scherer from the fire chiefs is not able to be here tonight, and I told him I would bring forward some of his comments that he had.
Thank you.
So it's great to be here, and thank you for the opportunity. A couple of things I'd like to address regards earlier testimony today, and it has to do with the fact that I know the builder said they believe in safety, and I think that to be true. But you know, 8 to 10 years ago, we the fire service had brought a bill forward, asking the builders to help us just by handing out a pamphlet. The fire service would pay for it, handing out a pamphlet to potential home buyers to inform them on fire sprinklers in their homes. And not only did they refuse to do that, but they had the bill defeated. And this is just an educational process. So I'm not quite sure where they stand on the safety issues that they say that they want to do. But I guess we can talk about that a little later. But I think it's important to get all the facts, because they did say that. And then also there was a comment made about a task force that was formed last fall to look into this issue with all the working groups involved to try and come to conclusion. I know there were some points brought forward, and I think other testifiers will probably hit on this a little more. The fact is that after the initial meeting started, the builders then walked away and said, we're not interested anymore, and we're concerned about that. We had, in good faith, went to the table and thought we'd have some discussions, and it's my understanding that they just decided they didn't want to talk and did not attempt to try and negotiate through some of these points. So I thought it was important to bring that up. But what I wanted to talk about, and the fact that I represent 15,000 fire departments for the Fire Department Association, a little bit is firefighter safety. Yeah, it's a huge issue for us out there in the new construction, and in fact, some of the old construction out there. You saw a chart earlier today, and I'm sorry I don't have that with me, nor did I get a copy that showed you these homes by year and what year they may have been built. Well, you know, that's a sliding chart. In 10 years, you're going to see homes built in the last couple of years that are going to have more and more fires in it, and I hope you understand that that's a critical issue for us. This lightweight construction now, as Mr. Dom alluded to, makes us get firefighters out of that home that much quicker. Now, keeping in mind that 90% of the firefighters in the state of Minnesota are paid on call or volunteer, and I certainly want to make sure that every one of those people, along with our career firefighters, of course, come home after the event. And Senator Youngbauer, you said earlier your son was on the department, and I think that's great. I want to make sure he comes home. I fight fires with him in East Bethel, and we'd go mutual aid, and I knew he was there. It's, you know, I believe in the safety of firefighters, and this to me is a firefighter issue just as much as anything else. If we can't get there and have an opportunity to at least attempt to put the fire out, we're in big trouble. We have a 15-minute accountability check. In that 15 minutes, we're pulling people out now because we can't fight fire in that structure anymore. It's probably beyond capabilities to be safe for us. It's starting to fail much sooner now than it ever was. So we have to be very careful of that, whereas I truly believe that a sprinkler system will allow us to at least have a fighting chance if somebody's in there to go get them and get them out of there. So that's a huge issue to me. And, of course, bringing our firefighters home.
Excuse me, Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't even know where we're at. Sorry, and I apologize. I'm got stuff going on up in Commerce Committee at the same time with no-fault auto insurance, which is a big issue as well.
Stay here.
As we're looking at this issue, a couple things come to mind, and so I'd like you to maybe kind of answer a couple questions. Is when the codes are developed, and as a builder of 25 years, I know what's available out there, what would be the difference of pushing a structure that's literally fireproof as opposed to sprinkler system? Because we know we can build SIP panels, for example, double fire sheetrock will handle a 1.5 hour 2400 degree burn, which means it's basically not going to start on fire. Just the contents could start on fire. So that would, you know, protect folks as well. And if it is so cheap, which I still challenge you on, because, again, I went and talked to a number of people in the break, and why don't all firefighters have their houses sprinkled? If it's that cheap and that effective, I only talked to one firefighter that has a sprinkler system in his home.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, my home is sprinkled. Oh. I can tell you that, and I know a number of others who have it. Not all, of course, that I believe that. I know the firefighters and the fire service obviously promote that because we believe in that safety issue. Most of them, I don't know of too many of them building new homes. I think they would consider that. I know of a few that in the last couple of years have had their homes sprinkled when they built new homes. But I can only use Andover as an example. We're a little bit older fire department in that our average experience is more in the neighborhood of close to 20 years now, and we have 50 paid on-call members. And so I don't have a lot of them building new homes, but I know they believe it. And I have given information to some of our members. Whether or not they'll pursue it, I can't tell. I hope so. They truly see the value in that. And, you know, and again, we talk about safety every day at all of our training exercises. Every time we go out the door and that pager goes off, I want to make sure you come home safe. And so I can only hope that someday they'll have an opportunity to do that in their homes.
Senator Jungbauer.
Again, Mr. Chair, and thanks. I kind of challenged people with the earlier one to bring back some estimates and put us in touch with some companies that we could actually verify these costs, because that is really one of the biggest issues, that if it costs, you know, a couple thousand bucks to sprinkle a home, I certainly mm-hmm. would think that was great, and that's kind of the amount you're been alluding to on a, you know, a couple $100,000 entry-level house, which today is even cheaper. So did anybody bring back that information of who's doing those systems for that kind of money, and how do we get a hold of them? Because I believe if they're really that cost, these people would have all kinds of business literally overnight. We'd be lucky to have them and be able to convince them to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Jungbauer, I think our next testifier has some numbers for you.
Great.
So we'll certainly have that for you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and, cool. And just closing, I know if I, Mr. Chair, sorry.
Sure.
You know, Mr. the fire Wright. Service is not the enemy here. Our issue is protecting lives and property, and we certainly would respect the committee to understand what we're all about, and that we understand there are costs involved. There's no doubt about it. It's going to increase the cost or not of homes. I mean, the homeowner, a new homeowner, has to make some decisions as you heard earlier, they may want to cut back in other areas if the bottom line is an issue for them. I'm not here to make that call, but we certainly understand all of the points. It's a fact that we want to make sure everybody is safe in these structures out there. Back in 1983, we adopted Appendix 1306. That was for commercial and industrial buildings to sprinkle them, and the fire losses in those types of buildings has gone down dramatically since they've had sprinklers installed in them. And I think that's a huge attribute to what fire sprinklers can do for them. So in closing, Mr. Chair and members, let's hope that this isn't so much a money issue, because I hate to think that we could put a value on one life, just one life. And we talked about some testifiers talked earlier. Well, we've only had one or two fatalities in 20 years, 30 years, 10 years, whatever the numbers were. I'm sorry, I don't recall. But, you know, I can't go to that family at the end of the event and say, you know, I just found your relative, your husband, your wife, your son, your daughter in the house, knowing that we could have prevented that or certainly had a good opportunity to prevent that. And when I tell them that the fire sprinklers maybe would have prevented that, and tell them that it was only a $4,000 or $5,000 cost, that's pretty tough to swallow at that point. So I appreciate you listening, and I'll stand for any questions. I know there are others to testify to.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to comment. I don't think philosophically that government can eliminate all risks for all people. And there's a balancing act that has to be done here by policymakers. And I respect your view. I'm sure in your circumstances I would have the exact same position. However, it's incumbent upon us to look at all the costs of adopting a policy like that and the costs of adopting a policy in a piecemeal fashion and what the impact is to our economy, our home purchasers, our developers, our retailers. And the price of housing is not good right now. I mean, the housing market is not good. And I think one of the reasons, perhaps, is this piecemeal approach to big policies like that. And so I disagree with you, sir, and I'm going to support Senator Limmer's bill. It's not because I don't want to protect another life. It's that I'm trying to weigh these balances. And when I do the balancing, I find that it goes too far for government to impose this burden right now. I might disagree later. Others are right to disagree with me, but I think right now it's up to us to balance that, weigh what our conscience and good policy mandates. And for me, it goes too far to think that we can protect everybody from risks. And if we were going to adopt your view, then we would try and build homes that were theft-proof. We would try and somebody said take all the bathtubs out because people drown in bathtubs. I just don't think government can be expected to do all that. I think it's too much. And so I respectfully disagree with you. But it's not because I'm not concerned about safety or that I'm not concerned about folks that have died in tragic fires. It's that I think there's a balance that has to be made here.
Okay, next testifier.
My name is Sean Flaherty. I'm here on behalf of the contractor members of the NFSA Region 15 Minnesota chapter. And basically, I wanted to come in today to talk about the costs of fire sprinkler systems, residential fire sprinkler systems specifically. A couple of items were brought up a little earlier today with regard to costs in rural scenarios, and I just wanted to shed some light on our numbers that we have seen in that regard. With regard to water storage tanks and supplemental pressure pumps being used, we have typically seen a $1,500 to $2,000 price tag associated with that sort of an extra feature on a fire sprinkler system if a municipal water supply is not available. Now, there may have been a little confusion earlier. Some of what Senator Jungbauer had discussed may have concerned commercial systems as opposed to residential. The residential systems have a much more lax code requirement as far as what's required for water supplies and water durations, in that it is strictly a life-saving code as opposed to a property protection type code. You're only looking to furnish a 10-minute water supply to ensure that the inhabitants of the home will get out safely. And in order to do that, you can have a relatively small water supply stored on site. In most cases, about a 300-gallon water storage tank is sufficient. That's something that could fit in your mechanical room. It's roughly the size of a 100-gallon water heater or a larger furnace. And most pumps that we see are typically between 1.5 and 3 horsepower pumps, fairly inexpensive devices as well. So the price tag for this extra feature in rural Minnesota isn't quite as outlandish as some people have stated earlier.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm sorry I wrote your first name down, but not your last name.
Sean Flaherty.
Flaherty, like a good Irish name. So, Mr. Flaherty, did you bring some costs for us to see? I mean, I deal with plumbing wholesalers, and I'm a septic designer, wastewater designer. We deal with pumps and supply tanks and electrical control panels all day long, and you know, I just don't see the kind of, my cost for these kind of units is extremely expensive. So I'd like to see the components and the wholesale costs on what you're talking about, because again, it's to me inconceivable. Even when you said 1 to 3 horse pump, I do 3/4 horse pumps, and they're $300 just for the pump, and that doesn't include any of the wiring, any of the controls for it. Supply tanks, even 300-gallon supply tanks. I don't know what kind of specs you're putting them to, but a 300-gallon tank for us is about $486 wholesale, you know. So you just put those two things together plus a control panel, you got $1,500 for raw costs plus all the installation and anything else. So I'm not talking a 1 to 3 horse pump. So I don't even envision it. And again, I was talking on a residential. The last bid we got was $8,900 on a residential and a small commercial unit because of the supply required of water, again, out in the country. It was $89,000. So it had a huge storage tank, I think 3,000 gallons for the commercial, but not a large square footage. But again, the pumps, the types of supply lines and everything, the control panels, everything required. So again, and Senator Ortman put it beautifully, we would love to save every life. I would love to, after my experience last week, not have any car ever hit a pedestrian in a crosswalk. We can't protect everyone, and it's not the government's job to impose everything for everyone. But certainly, if the discussion brings the cost down, if we are made aware of things and somehow the public is aware that this option is available for as cheap as you're purporting it to be, I can't imagine anybody not wanting it in a house. I really can't. It's just something that just seems like an option that's kind of a gimme. I mean, I'm looking at possibly building a new smaller house this summer, and if it's really that cheap, chair and committee members, there's no way I would build the house without it if it's that cheap. But again, I need numbers. I need some data, and otherwise it doesn't make sense to me because I know what I've seen out in the public before.
Sure, and I'd be happy to furnish you a quote.
Mr. Flair, do you want to finish up?
Yes, sir. Again, I think we are talking apples and oranges here as far as costs are concerned. In residential sprinkler systems, we're not required to use any listed materials. There are no control panels associated with the pumps, strictly a pressure switch, just like you'd have on a well system. So it is a fairly simplistic system. No listings on the tanks, and the numbers that you quoted as far as tanks and pumps are fairly accurate. That, in conjunction with the labor associated, would put us in the $1,500 to $2,000 range. So I don't think we're very far off there. I do not have those facts and figures in front of me right now, but I'd be more than happy to get those for you.
Thank you.
Any other? Are you finished?
I'm Mr. finished. Flaherty? Thank you for your time.
Okay. Any other testifiers? Yes. If you'll come to the table. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Senators. My name is Bob Kleinheinz. I'm the North Central Regional Manager for the National Fire Sprinkler Association. I have 32 years in the fire service and just retired as Assistant Chief in Northern Illinois. I'm proud to say I live in a sprinklered home, and my community is a residential sprinkler community, along with 71 other communities in Northern Illinois. I know that's not Minnesota, but I just want to let you know that it is out there. There's just a couple of statistics that were given earlier in the day, and the Senators just walked out because they're the ones who brought it up. So I want everyone to hear. They were very big on statistics, and one statistic that he really was big on was fire loss versus sprinkler fire loss. And we want to let you know that there is a 15-year study that was just recently completed from Scottsdale, Arizona. The Arizona community is one of the largest sprinkler communities in the country, with thousands of sprinkler homes throughout Arizona. Scottsdale, at the end of the study, had 598 sprinkler homes in their town or in their city. This study went from 1999 to 2001. Out of the 598 homes, 49 of those homes were sprinklered homes out of the 598 that were studied. Out of the 15-year study, the fire loss in a sprinklered home was an average of $2,100 when there was a fire in a sprinklered home. That same average loss in a non-sprinklered home in Scottsdale was $45,000. Now, that was in 2001, and you can take those figures and you can raise them because we all know the cost of materials nowadays. A fire in a home in my area is going to easily exceed that $200,000 mark. That's just the way my homes are. Probably the same way up here. So those were some of the statistics. And something that was thrown out, and I just wanted to correct some information that was given out earlier today by some testimony from the Building Association. They talked about smoke detectors and when smoke detectors were enacted, and they talked about years, and they said that smoke detectors were hardwired and interconnected in 1980, and that's not true. In 1980, in the late 70s and early 80s is when we were actually fighting to put smoke detectors in the market. They were all battery operated, and they cost about $50 a piece. The BOCA code is the code that was enforced back in the 90s. The 1993 BOCA code is the first time that smoke detectors were proven to be hardwired, and that was put into the code. The major change from the 1993 code to the 1996 BOCA code is when they were interconnected and they were now required in all levels. So I just wanted to make sure that everyone understood that. In 1980, there were no hardwired requirements, nor were there any interconnected requirements until the middle to late 1990s. And we also, from a national perspective, we know we talked about it before, we shouldn't even be talking about sprinklers. Right now, we should be talking about education to everyone in this area about sprinklers, but this goes farther. It goes to what everyone over here has testified. This is a rulemaking process that you have already accepted. So we need to leave the rulemaking process as is, let the departments do their jobs, and let the codes go through the natural process. Don't stop it just because there's a builders group or any other group in your state that would like to come forward and say, we don't like this, change the code. It won't stop there. And we're seeing that across the country. As AHJs and building officials, whenever someone doesn't see the new electrical standards and they don't like it, they go to legislatively stop it. They don't like the new stair standards, they go to legislatively stop it. This is not just about sprinklers. This is about attempts across the country from different organizations to stop new safety standards. We didn't stop seatbelts. We didn't stop airbags. Those are things that are mandated, and they save thousands of lives a year. We're still losing 3,000 people every year in the United States. The only other point I want to make is the chiefs talked about response times. I want you to please think about response times in your own home. The clock starts when the fire starts. The clock doesn't start when that tone goes off at the fire station or the 911 call is received. The two-minute response that he talked about and the person perished in that fire, you have to add another 5-6 minutes onto that because you don't know when the call was received. So thank you again for allowing us to speak, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the point regarding rulemaking, I just want to remind the members that rulemaking authority comes directly from the legislature.
Correct.
And if the legislature desires to enter into this arena, it has every right to do that. The other comment that I will make as long as I've got the mic at this point is, so far I haven't heard any testimony whatsoever to indicate that individuals who want to put sprinkler systems in their homes do not have a right to do that. And I would just indicate that I agree with what Senator Ortman has expressed. And if folks want to put sprinkler systems in their homes, they can do so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And, Senators, we agree with that. It's
excuse
just
me
that,
one
that
second.
Hasn't even gone to that.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, again, sorry I'm going back and forth between getting some stuff done for other committees. You talked about the codes, and I didn't hear your name, so I'm sorry I can't address you properly. But can you – somebody tell me at least why, when these codes are being developed, whether it's the building code or the fire code, they're copyrighted books. They're not out in the public. They're hidden from the public. The public doesn't have any input in the process when we have valuable people out there that actually know what's going on. These are behind closed door things. And even if I want to find the fire code, and I mentioned this earlier, it is a copyrighted thing. I have to buy a $90 book in order to find out what kind of stuff you're trying to enforce on people. I think that's ridiculous. In fact, you'll see some legislation coming from me to not allow us to adopt any books or codes that are copyrighted, that during the process, I'm in the process of working that language up, that it has to be visible to the public, because I think it's a travesty. This is why the legislature hears this, is because we don't find out about it till it's a problem that somebody's trying to push through a copyrighted hidden code that nobody has access to.
Senator, I can only answer that by it's not hidden. It might be a copywritten book because it's written by a code organization, but the people that sit on this side of the room and behind us, if you need to come to the ICC code hearings, they're the ones that bring all the codes forward for us.
Mr. Chair, members,
Senator Jungbauer.
It is a hidden process when it's happening. We don't have access to what you're talking about, how you're developing the codes. You cannot find the codes online because they're copyrighted. So every time I have a constituent, which I have six complaints on the fire code in different areas today, and our fire marshal was nice enough to lend me a copy of the fire code so that I could read it and understand, because when somebody's getting a letter from their city, when something's being enforced upon them, they can't even find what is the city's trying to enforce on them. It's ludicrous that our citizens are treated that way by folks that are paid for by taxpayer dollars.
Chief Dom, did you want to weigh in on this one?
I would just comment on the rule, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Jungbauer, I just comment on the rulemaking process as Senator Newman has so rightly pointed out. The authority to promulgate rules come from the Minnesota legislature. And that is a process designed by the legislature that involves a lengthy public notification process, hearing process, opportunity for people to speak to the codes. Notice for comment is placed in the state register. There is a notification of the rulemaking process on websites. Aside from sending a letter to every constituent in Minnesota, I don't know how we could make it more informative than what we do. We try very hard to make sure that the public is aware and all constituent groups are aware of the rulemaking process in accordance with the provisions established by the Minnesota legislature. In terms of the model code, Senator Jungbauer, I believe that the statute requires us to adopt a code based on a national standard. And so that's the process that we go through, not only with the state fire code, but also with the billing code and other codes that I'm familiar with, that our office is involved with. In terms of being able to find information about the code, we have a staff person in our office and other people scattered around the state, 19 inspectors that are constantly answering questions about the fire code and providing documentation to people who seek specific references to the fire code. We do that on a daily basis. We probably handle a couple hundred calls and emails a week from constituents that have questions about codes.
Okay, so
that is available by phone as it is by email. All of the state amendments are posted on our website as well as code interpretations.
Senator Jungbauer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you make my argument so wonderfully, because if we actually had the code out there for the public to see, we could have less employees. We wouldn't have to be answering questions all day long because people can't find something that they should have total and free access to. As far as the rulemaking process, it is a joke. I've fought it for many years. In fact, our former PCA commissioner, I see him sitting back there, knows this will be my ninth year fighting what a travesty our rulemaking process is, that only certain people are invited to the table, that even though they go through the comment period, those comments are typically thrown to the side. And I'll use the PCA as an example. 70% of everybody licensed by the PCA was not even allowed to comment or be in hearings and be part of the last rulemaking process by the Pollution Control Agency on wastewater on-site systems. It is unelected, unaccountable people putting rules down for all of us to have to live by. And as far as I'm concerned, this is another example of something, and this is why the legislature gets involved in the code, is because we have no other way except authority to take and X something out and say, we're not going to go for this.
Back to the bill members. We have a testimony in the middle here. If you'd tell us your name and give us your testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Senator Ingridson. Gentleman in the blue, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I've been stepping out back and forth, if I might, Mr. Chair, one question.
Senator Ingridson.
Back and forth I was going as well.
What was your name again?
Bob Kleinheinz.
Kleinheinz.
Mr. Kleinheinz, I just want to know, who do you represent?
National Fire Sprinkler Association.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Sir.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Tom Joachim. I represent the Association of Minnesota Building Officials, AMBO. AMBO is an organization representing the building officials and building inspectors who perform the inspections of single-family homes in the municipalities who have adopted our state building code. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House File 460 for the following reasons. Deputy Fire Marshal Bob Dom talked about the rule process, so I'm not going to repeat some of that
Thank you.
Testimony. I'm going to hit on a couple of points. I need to backtrack a little bit here. So I retired officially December 29th of this year after 27 years of state service. I was the assistant commissioner and prior to that the state building official responsible for adoption of the state building code for almost 19 years. So I have plenty of experience in the past history of what we've been doing here in Minnesota. The department held three meetings last fall to gather this group together to try and look at and see if we could come with any common ground about what here's what the new code language is going to say. Is there any common ground between sprinkler everything and not sprinkler anything? Is there any common ground for us to look at? We held three meetings. At the last meeting, the builders did come out with a letter stating that they were in opposition to any movement towards sprinklers, but at least they did come out with 14 points of concern that they addressed in their letter. The fire service also responded with 6 or 8 points of concern that they addressed in their response. I felt that was a good starting point for our advisory task force that would then be looking at this once the new codes are published. The new codes are going to be published sometime this month or early in May, and the department normally goes through a code adoption process that takes 18 months, has an advisory committee that listens to all the people that are here about why or why not we should amend or keep the rules and regulations that are in the model document that we look at. Representing AMBO, we would like to see the rules process be allowed to work and function and give the industries time for input. If the builders so choose and the legislature would so choose, next year the legislature could pass a prohibition on sprinkling. But this issue has not been thoroughly vetted through the rules process. And representing the code officials today, we would like to recommend that that happen. I'm going to give you one example, and you're always, Senator Jungbauer is always interested in statistics. On the State Fire Marshal website, I do not have it with me, but it's on the State Fire Marshal website on their yearly report, lists the fires that are in Minnesota. And one of the statistics is 47% of the residential fires start in the kitchen. With the language that you have in your bill, it would limit the department that they could not look at any type of a sprinkler system, a 1 or 2 or 3 head partial system. We discussed that at these three advisory task force meetings and discussed the issue of if 47% of the fires could be stopped with one head put in a kitchen and every new home built, that would stop a lot of fires in future Minnesota. To me, that's a cost-effective method. The state building code law that you established for the department to look at rules states that, one, we have to look at model codes where applicable, two, we have to address Minnesota amendments if they're needed, and three, we have to look at cost-effective code construction. To me, that's something that, the way the language reads, it would not allow even a one-head system to be looked at to say this is a cost-effective method to save a lot of fires in the future, new homes in construction in Minnesota. So I think we're missing the opportunity to look at least partial systems in Minnesota to save some dollars and save some construction in the future. There was a question addressed by Senator Latz, I believe it was, in regard to previous statutory language that mandated some type of code language. And has there been? Yes. Most of the time it's been retroactive language, for example, the bleacher law. New construction requires bleachers to comply to bleacher safety requirements. 5-6 years ago, we had a number of bleacher accidents, and there's nothing that was retroactive. So then the legislature decided to pass a building code law that was retroactive back to bleacher safety. So there has been some that have applied. In most cases, we've been able to do it through the rule process. 85% of the time, the department, and prior to January 1st of this year, we were able to resolve the rules process without any public hearings. And even when we did have public hearings, we generally resolved them without having to go through a full public hearing because we finally got the parties together to say, okay, this is it. You either make a decision or this administrative law judge is going to make a decision for you. So in the end, we believe this legislation is premature. We would like to see the rules process given an opportunity to discuss and debate these specific code issues and at least the opportunity to look at some type of partial systems in single-family homes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Latz.
Mr. Joachim, you kind of ran through it a little quickly. I didn't catch.
the criteria you said that is supposed to be used to guide the decisions, you said that I think there were 3 points that you're supposed to evaluate. Could you repeat those for me, please?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, within the state building code, and we changed the number, so it's 326B101 or 103 or something, 121, 103 I think it is, if I remember right. It basically says under the state building code title, it says the department is responsible to adopt a state building code that addresses different types of construction and methods, et cetera. And then it goes on to 3 categories. It says look at model building codes where applicable, address Minnesota amendments where needed, and then the last sentence, I believe it says something to the effect of cost-effective construction.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Latz.
So there is a provision in there where you're supposed to weigh the cost benefits relating to you would presumably sort out some of these disagreements over the costs in rural areas and septic systems that are related to it or water table issues and water tanks and so on as opposed to municipal water systems. And you'd weigh issues relating to retrofitting existing buildings versus only new construction, the costs involved in that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, yes. And that has always been the policy of the department to bring in all the parties, and your experience with PCA is a whole lot different than the experiences I would hope the industry would say that the department has handled over the years, is to bring everybody forward and talk about these issues and say what works, what doesn't work, and how are we going to address these issues specifically to have a win-win situation here. What's cost-effective, what's protecting the public, and how can we do that to maintain that within the amendments to the state codes or the model codes that we adopt?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz?
Thank you. I've been listening to this testimony now for a couple of hours and trying to sort out the issues in an area about which I know very little despite having served on a city council and having listened to some of this stuff, 10 years ago, I guess, and smaller amounts, and it's apparent to me just how little I really know about the scope of this and the range of even the options, because you're the first person that has mentioned the possibility of a partial system requirement that might be more cost effective and might cover almost half of the risks in a house fire. That hasn't been mentioned before, and I guess where my thinking is right now is that's the kind of thing which can come out in a rulemaking process that's not as easy to bring out in a legislative hearing where we're basically being asked to become experts in a field in a matter of 2 hours. Am I missing something here? Or maybe someone else might want to add something to that too. But
Mr. Chair, Senator Latz, you're absolutely correct. There's a number of issues that have been brought out. Should we, within sprinkling of a single-family home, should we address the escape window as a trade-off, or should we address other issues, firewalls and other things, the issue of the higher combustible construction that we have now in new homes and the open construction, which causes fires to spread faster. The provisions that are in the current code that will be code that will be published here very soon states that if you have open web construction, which is the popular design now of floors, and you don't finish your basement, you either have to sprinkler that basement or you have to sheetrock underneath there to protect that because the trusses burn so fast and they collapse so quick. So there's many provisions that are all intertwined as to what you make a decision on. If it's sprinklered, if it's not sprinklered, or partially sprinklered, what you need to look at. So those are the items that all get debated, discussed, hammered out, and the various industries get to come to the table and say, yes, this works, no, it doesn't work. How do we address this issue? So that's the rule process that happens through the department. I'm assuming it's going to continue on with a new leadership over at the department, but that's the process that I was charged to and to maintain over the last 19 years, and that's a process we use.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Joachim, I have a couple questions for you here. If the rules are finished, when would they be implemented?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, the Administrative Procedure Act that you, the legislature, established charges us, or excuse me, charges the agency, no longer the agency, to go through an adoption process with rules. The normal process is you advertise in the all the state register and get out notices to all of our. The department had lists of thousands of people that were on our list that we'd send out notices to. We established the advisory committee. The committee gets together to talk about various issues, starts to look at the amendments to the code that we previously had to the previous document to say, did the new code bring those in or not? Goes through that process. The normal process for that is about 18 months to get the final rule adopted from the data we have a published document to work from. Again, the document, I'm not aware it's been published yet, but they said sometime in April, early May. And we can't do that because the Administrative Procedure Act says you can't start a rule process unless you have a document available to the public to do that.
Okay.
So that's 18 months. And then five, six years ago, the builders passed legislation that would, one of the problems we always had with adopting codes is you never know when they're going to get passed and timing-wise, so it's always difficult to get training and education and get the amendments published at a reasonable time. So the builders passed legislation a few years ago that established another six-month window for training and education. So from the date that the department will start their rule process, it's 2 years till the time the code is adopted. So if they start July 1, it'll be 2 years from July 1 before this new language, whatever is decided and proposed, would come out, which would give, if needed, next session or even the next session to look at this.
Well, thank you, Mr. Joachim, and a couple other questions. So in other words, this wouldn't have to be passed this year. We could have both next session and the session after to discuss this and to get more information from what the rules are scheduled to be. So how much has been spent developing the rules? Anything?
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Joachim.
I'm not aware that the department has made any moves toward adoption yet.
Okay. So then my last question would be, is it true that in order to get a copy of these of the state fire code, that you'd have to spend $90 or what? I mean, isn't that information available to contractors, businesses and so forth that have to that are expected to abide by them, or do they actually have to buy for $90 a book or however much with the state fire code in it?
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Mr. Joachim.
When the department previously adopted rules, we made sure that the libraries, local libraries, had a copy of our amendments, and if they wanted to, they could purchase the code book, the model document, if they wanted to. Many of the libraries have the building code, fire code books. Every jurisdiction that adopts our state building code has at least three or four copies of them for citizens to come in and look at if they would want to look at those books. The model, the committees that we established, the advisory committees we established, if the participants don't have a code book, the department always provided a code book for them so they could review the documents to make sure they understood what the new provisions are so we could keep everybody up to speed on those documents.
Well, Mr. Chair, and
Senator Goodwin,
thank you, and Mr. Joachim. So all builders wouldn't have access to get these without purchasing them. I mean, to get their own copy, for example. The reason I'm asking this line of questions, it's off of Senator Jungbauer's question, but also I know that there are problems, and you and I have discussed this before, and I've worked on the issue for several years about home construction issues and mold and all the problems that we've had with homes in the last 15 to 20 years. And I also know that a number of builders don't follow building codes, period, let alone any new rules that we put up. So my concern is that if we don't make those codes available to them, both the building code and the state fire code, then it's even less likely that they're going to follow them. It's already a big building problem in the state with the, some of the problems we've had with home construction. And so I'm guessing that it's expensive to probably publish these things, but how can we expect people to follow them if we're going to charge so much for copies of the codes, if that's, or say you have to go to the library and look up the codes or whatever?
Chief Dom, would you like to weigh in?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodman, and then I'll let Fire Marshal Dom speak. One of the things that the department always did was provide training and education to the code officials and to the builders. And we've worked with the builders on many training programs where they've used our training programs, and so it's the same to make sure we're all saying the right thing. Every one of those training programs provides a booklet, a three-ring binder booklet with, I would say, a majority of, for sure, all the new code provisions that have been changed in the last version of the code. And then a lot of repetitive areas that seem to be the things that the builders seem to miss in during construction. And so they may not get the code book, and to me it's to their advantage to get the code book. We worked with the Model Code Organization, who publishes the International Residential Code, to insert our Minnesota Homegrown Plumbing Code, to insert our energy code in that, so we have a one document that they can buy, so that should cover the majority of what they're looking at in the codes for a single-family home. Yes, it still costs money, but that's a part of business. If you're going to be running a business, you should really know how you're supposed to be installing stuff, and that document is very helpful to the builders and the code officials to understand what it is. When I first started in this business, I was a consultant answering phone calls, and it's very easy for somebody to call in and ask for a code interpretation, and I'll ask them, please turn to Section 309, and I can explain that to you. Oh, I don't have a code book. Well, how are you supposed to be a builder and not understand what the provisions are when you're dealing with that? So, yes, there is a cost to business, and here's a cost to buying a code book, but we've tried to work with the Model Code Organization to combine the documents, especially for the residential builders, into one document to make it easier for them.
Okay. One final question. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I want to finish this because I think it's an important.
Senator Goodwin, let's stay on the bill, though.
It is.
We're getting off to the fire code. And
no, but I mean, we're talking about what it would take to do this.
Okay.
I hope that's what we're talking about. So the issue here is, though, that builders have to, in order to implement the new rules on sprinkler systems, would builders have to, in order to maintain their license or get their license as a contractor, general contractor, would they have to take these classes? I mean, are they obligated to take them? If they're not obligated to take them, how can we expect them to follow them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Joachim.
As Assistant Commissioner, our responsibility was also to license all of the industry. And licensing of residential building contractors requires every residential building contractor, remodeler, roofer, and manufactured home installer to obtain so much continuing education each year to maintain their license. Of the training programs that are generally put on by the department or the builders, addressed new requirements. So if there was any new sprinkler requirements put into the rules, that would be part of the training programs that would be put out to all the builders across the state who are licensed.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Senator Limmer, what would you like to do with this bill?
Sorry.
Did you have something? Senator Latz?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, earlier in the hearing, you had asked that we hold our questions until the longer list of witnesses had completed their testimony, and I held a question or two from one of the earliest witnesses.
I apologize. Go ahead.
And I wonder if I might just inquire briefly about that. And then, of course, I would love to hear what the chairman would like to do with the bill. I had a question for Ms. Linner regarding the statistics that she provided to us. Thank you. Ms. Linner, I've got the chart, the graph in front of me that you put together. And I understand these are raw numbers, and they're and I'm just wondering if you can put these into some context for us, because you had in the 90s and the 2000s there were six civilian fire deaths in single-family homes. But I'm trying to understand, is that out of how many houses that were new construction in those decades? Has the proportion of deaths changed? What's the proportion of the housing stock that those two decades represent in Minnesota? Because if in the 19, if half of our housing stock was built in the 1950s in Minnesota, you would expect to have a lot more deaths just from the numbers, regardless of construction and changes. I'm just trying to get my arms around that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Letts, I'd be happy to explain that. If you look at the one you're holding up, if you look at from 1990 to the 2000s, what I did was went and pulled all the permit data for that time frame. They're available annually for single-family construction. Then I took the average household number of people in households from the Minnesota Demography Office, and that's 2.5 people. So there's over, let me check that number for you. There were 431,000 single-family homes built during that time period from 1990 to 2010, and that housed over 1,086,000 Minnesotans based on the average household.
Yeah, so,
and Senator, as a fraction, your question, I believe, your second question, excuse me, was a follow-up of what fraction of that is in Minnesota construction for the entire housing stock. And right. Believe it or not, that's very hard to find because I look forward. But our calculations are at the rate of construction we have now, it would take 75 years if all the housing stock were destroyed and replaced with new construction based on the number of housing units that we're building.
Senator Letts.
So, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Linner, that suggests to me, with such a long time frame for replacement, that the rate of growth in the number of houses in Minnesota, or the number of houses that are built each year, has slowed considerably compared to the late 40s and the 1950s, especially. I assume that's the post-World War II housing boom. That's reflected in some of that growth there, too.
Senator Mr. Lennon. Chair, Senator Letts, I wish I had the numbers in front of me, but I believe the building permit numbers are currently for single-family homes down to 1969? I believe it's 1969, last time I looked, okay. The equivalent numbers. So to talk about, well, let me put it this way. If you threw a dart at all the housing stock in Minnesota, I think your question is how likely are you to come up with a single-family home in the 1990s and in the year 2010, right?
Yeah.
And you're a million homes likely. I don't have in front of me the number of single-family homes in Minnesota, but we could do the math pretty quick since there's – I'm trying to think of the population if anyone knows it.
Okay. And then one other question, if I may. Ms. Linner, I'm not sure if you're the right person to answer this, but this document here, was this also provided by your organization?
Yes, that's from the National Association of Home Builders.
On the back it says that it lists Minnesota as having the mandate defeated by Minnesota regulatory letter without any more detailed explanation. Could you tell me what that means?
Absolutely. Chair, Senator Letts, what that means is currently we're working under the 2006 international codes in Minnesota. The 2007 state building code is based on the 2006, except for the homegrown ones that Mr. Joachim mentioned previously. So what happened was when the 2009 codes were available, the Department of Labor and Industry and the State Fire Marshal's Office issued a joint statement that they would not be adopting the 2009 codes. Now, in the 2009 I-codes, there's also a requirement for mandatory sprinklers in single-family homes. So why Minnesota is blue is because during that code cycle, in either 2009 or the next code cycle, they've already not adopted that code.
Okay.
And that happened through, it did not happen through the rules-making process. The Department of Labor and Industry made that decision.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I came into this hearing honestly leaning in favor of the bill for the reasons that you've heard described on the record, and I've learned a lot about building codes and about the process, and I guess there's a reason why the legislature delegated some of this responsibility to the rulemaking process, is because it's hard, I think, for me anyway, to get my arms around some of the details, become expert in this, and evaluate all the different inputs that should be considered. I'm concerned about cost of building the houses, and especially its impact on affordable housing. I'm also concerned about safety and, you know, the stories that we've heard, and I've been struggling to find the right balance here, and I think maybe the fact that I'm struggling is why we have a rulemaking process, for some of those struggles to go on among the experts, and a more lengthy process to take the public input and interpret it. And if in the end we don't like the outcome, I guess we always have the prerogative to go and override that rulemaking process. But I'm a bit concerned that even as the hearing is going on longer, we're learning more, and I'm kind of feeling like I'm moving this way and then moving this way on it, and I think that's telling me maybe this isn't the right forum to make this decision, but it needs a more lengthy process of public input and consideration and weighing of the criteria that Mr. Joachim identified, and I've looked them up on the statute, and they're here. You know, the entire state building code is a mandate, so I don't know that we can simply rest on the principle that we shouldn't, as a state, be mandating certain criteria for how we build our houses, even single-family homes. And my initial reaction was, geez, require sprinklers throughout every single-family home? That's kind of stiff. On the other hand, I'm hearing some comments that, you know, maybe there's a way that it can be done that might be more cost-effective and still address some of the safety concerns that I hadn't thought of before, but that would come out in the rulemaking process and ought to be considered by the experts. And so I think I'm at this point, especially the intertwining provisions and how the broad language in the bill would interact on the other kinds of code issues that might come up in a well-balanced code. So at this point, I think I'm inclined to vote against the bill.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I suppose Senator Limmer wants to sum up his bill. I just want to say I agree with Senator Latz, and I'm actually quite concerned and a little disappointed that we didn't have anybody from the insurance industry up here, because I would guess that they would definitely support this provision when they are responsible for homeowners insurance. So I don't know. Normally, quite frankly, we've had the Builders Association and the insurance industry together on some issues, and I'm hoping that that doesn't mean that the insurance industry wouldn't give us their honest opinion about whether or not we should be doing this, because I think that's needed here as well. I also oppose the bill because I think we've got time to go through this issue in the future, and I think just because one group came in, or one or two groups came in and asked us to do this now, I remember a couple years ago there was a bill that passed that was putting carbon monoxide detectors in every home, and I thought that was a little, that people, individual family homeowners had to do that, I thought that was a little I'm wrong, but this is definitely a life-saving situation, and I know that on one half we hear from the building industry that homes are built so well now, and then we hear from the fire chiefs that homes go up much faster now. I would tend to agree with the fire chiefs on that issue because I have really taken a look at the construction over the last few years, 15 years or so, and know that the construction is not what it should be in any way, shape, or form, and that the products used are much more flammable as well as more open to mold and other problems. And so I think this is something that we shouldn't. I have one question for Senator Limmer, and that is, if your bill passed here, that wouldn't even allow local governments or counties to set up to set up a provision that you had to put sprinklers in new homes. Am I correct or wrong? And that would say we couldn't even allow county and local governments to have their own ordinances or whatever that would require sprinkler systems in their particular county or locality.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, it's good to be back into the committee debate. Senator Goodwin, you're correct.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and then Senator Limmer, then see that we're talking about invading in personal decisions, and that should be a local decision, if not a state decision, in my opinion. So when we prohibit local governments from making these decisions to protect their own residents, I think we're going too far then, too. That's an issue that we're probably shouldn't be involved in, because local governments do want to develop. They want to develop, and they do want new homes in their communities. But if they think this is important enough that they want to make their own separate provision, and we're not even going to allow them to do that, then I think we're overstepping the bounds.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, you said it's not a personal decision. You're wrong in that. The consumer will not make any personal decision now, because you, I think, wish not to go forward this and allow a government department to make the decision unilaterally without representational vote on it. And you, by your vote today, will dictate to your consumer that they have to take a sprinkler system that may cost anywhere from $2,000 to upwards of maybe $8,000 out of the cost of their new home. You aren't giving the consumer any choice, but you're going to give government the choice. That's where you and I may philosophically differ.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Limmer. I understand what you're saying, but I also believe that we already set building code standards, and we should. We have to, because the consumer is buying a product that is probably the most expensive investment they're ever going to make. And for most people, it's the most expensive investment. We currently are not protecting that consumer with our current laws and requiring builders to be responsible for the 10-year warranty that is currently on the homes. But yet, without building codes, without those standards, there'd be some even more shoddy construction than what we have now, and there'd be more unsafe conditions for homeowners. So this is just another part, in my mind, of the building codes and standards and the safety issues. And, Senator Limmer, I don't think you can argue that this legislature, including you, has many, many times voted on safety issues for people, including seat belts and other things that were a result of maybe the insurance industry coming in and saying this would really save lives and this would really save costs and so forth. And I know that has been an issue here, and everybody's done it. We've all voted for it. This is something that not only would possibly save the lives of the people in the home, but would save firefighters' lives as well. And I came in the same way Senator Latz did, not knowing how I'm feeling like perhaps this was, you know, maybe a little imposition. But I am convinced that this is a good safety measure, and that the consumer would not be told necessarily by the builder or whatever that this was an option for them. I think I heard testimony that said they wouldn't even hand out flyers before or informational things. I know that's true even now with home warranties, that people are not getting a copy of a home warranty, or that fact that we have statutory provisions on home warranties. So I doubt that in many cases that would happen either, and so people wouldn't even realize that that was their option, or they wouldn't have the ability to racket down those costs on those things if they wanted to. So in light of that, I'm sorry, Senator Limmer, I would like to support this, but I really think this is something that we should wait on.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, I didn't think I'd have to get into a history lesson, but a few short years ago, Mr. Joachim and I were in front of a committee like this, about 1999, 2000, 2001, where we were responding to what the government had already approved, the 2000 Energy Code. Are you familiar with the 2000 Energy Code that was approved by the government, this government, the state government? That was the code that led to all of the molded out houses. The builders built the homes according to the law. They had government inspectors approve their construction. Once that government inspection was done, that allowed the closing of that house, and those innocent little families could move into them. That was all due to trusting the government in their establishment of building codes. And we've been dealing with that problem for over a decade, trying to remediate the error. Now, the problem with that was is that when the homeowner, the consumer, wanted to be restored some loss, they didn't sue the government. They didn't sue the building inspectors that signed off on the job that they had done. They went back to the builder who followed the law. And that's where we've had all this problem before. So whenever I see a new building code, I just get a little nervous. I hope you would too. But, Mr. Chair, this we've gone down this path for quite some time. What are we at? 3, 4, 5 hours now in discussion. We had 20 minutes of proponents giving their side of the story, and this committee allowed almost an hour and a half to 2 hours for the opponents. I think the testifying is over, and we need to make a decision on the policy direction of this state. Now, the question is, they're on the horizon is whether or not we're going to include what's beginning to appear as a mandatory plumbing requirement to put in sprinkler systems in every home in this state. Now, I agree it would be a good thing to have in a house, but Senator Jungbauer, he asked the questions. He wanted to inquire about the prices of what it would take. He got a quote, maybe $2,000. Sounds like a good deal. But Senator Jungbauer, you have the luxury of making the decision. If we do nothing, if this state does nothing, if you're going to buy a new house, you won't have that choice. It'll be dictated to you. Now, some people may think that an extra $3,000, $4,000, $8,000 is no big deal, and that you just add it on to all of the other energy code things. And you know that thing about lightweight construction? Guess what? That'll be approved on the next building building code too, because they wouldn't put lightweight construction in unless it was approved, Senator Goodwin. And so when we look at this, we have to look at it in its total cost, but there is a cost impact to the consumer. There's a cost impact to those that are trying to find new homes in low-income areas. This keeps pushing that home dream away from those families. Every year we put a major cost factor on a house. Now, the way I heard this discussion, you'd think that sheetrock or other building components don't have a resistance. Some building materials do to fire resistance. It's put into our law. It's tested first, but it's put into our law. We have it under our HUD federal requirements. HUD, if they thought it was such a good deal, why aren't they advocating for sprinkler systems in every home in the United States? I look at the way this state goes, and we keep adding things, and we keep taking away the dream of owning a home away from people. And it's because we keep adding regulation. Or who knows, maybe there's just an overzealous lobbyist for an industry that thinks that every house has to have a sprinkler system in it. And to the tune of $4,000 to $8,000, that might be good. Jobs, 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 but it's no house, no house, no house for a lot of people. I heard the concern and the statement that the fire service is not the enemy. I agree with that. These guys do work that most of us wouldn't even dream of doing. nor would we ever want to imagine doing and seeing the things that they see. But there's a balance. There's a balance in what we provide to our consumers. And there's a balance, and there should be a balance of what we provide in the way of regulation. But sprinkler systems, as good an idea that they are for those who wish to have them, is not a key component to the construction of a home to satisfy the requirement for people to own something, to build something, maybe to have a little piece of that piece of American life that has been eluding them for a long time. I've been active in the real estate industry for 33 years. I sold new construction at that time. I came here and warned this legislature about the mold problem that was going to happen. And it took a long time. Did you know who was creating the building codes at one time before the year 2000? It was the Commerce Department. Not the Standards and Codes Division of the Department of Administration, the Commerce Department, the ones that hold real estate licenses, insurance licenses, all those licensed professions. They're the ones that were creating the building codes, and for much of those years they got sucked in by this idea that if a little insulation's good, a lot of insulation's better, and that's where thousands of our consumers have homes that are rotted out down to the foundation, and shame on us for allowing that to happen. So, Mr. Chair, this one paragraph of bill is before you. You have to make a choice. Are we going to require for many people an expensive cost to the construction of a new home? Or to require it, we would like to prohibit it from being imposed on existing homes. In a time when we have economic duress to begin with, we have a building industry that's near collapse, and now we have the people that aren't elected wanting to impose and consider putting a sprinkler system into a home, I can only imagine what even more that's going to do to those people who are weighing out the balance of buying a new home and recognizing costs, or buying a home that's significantly reduced by discount due to the economic conditions in this country. The home construction industry is almost at an end in our state. You don't find any new building starts too much anywhere. But putting this type of cost on them, you want to talk about jobs, we're going to lose jobs if we impose sprinklers in it. I've probably gotten a little more emotional about this issue than I care. But nevertheless, there's a history here. There's a history where the government, in the way of rulemaking, isn't the cure-all, and neither is letting legislators get involved with writing building code. But this isn't building code. This is allowing the addition of a sprinkler system at a high cost to be added on to the price of a house. I'm asking you to prohibit that in law, because I don't think it's necessary. I'll stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you. Just real quickly, Senator Limmer, and thank you for that. Have the townships, counties, or cities came forth?
I have not.
And wanted this ability to mandate? Today, I'm sorry, I've been bouncing in and out.
Well,
I didn't see him here.
Mr. Chair, any mandating is done by state, by the state building code. They're supposed to follow the state building code. Oftentimes, the interpretation of the state building code differs from really down to each building inspector sometimes. We're trying to uniform that. But I have not heard any comment from any political subdivision.
Thank you.
Okay. We've had a lot of discussion, so let's try to wrap things up if we could. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things, Senator. we're never going to agree on the issue of the home construction. But there are a couple things I want to correct, and that is you said something about that building inspectors inspect these places before they can close on them. Well, in that. The homeowner has no ability or right to go sue the city building inspectors because we prohibit it in law, for one thing. So they can't go back and sue them and say, you didn't find these problems. The other thing is that there's structural engineers that will gladly come here and testify that the people that the homes that they've inspected that have been, let's just say, honestly, shoddy construction has not been as a result of the building code. That those homes that they've inspected that are rotting and so forth are homes that have not followed the building code. So I want to make that perfectly clear that if you get structural engineers here that have done nothing but inspections on these homes, they will tell you that they have rarely, if ever, found a home that is a result of the state building code's problem. It is a result of the fact that the building codes were not followed, especially flashings and roofs and things like that. So I just want to make that clear. We're not going to get this issue solved, I'm sure. But at any rate, I really think we have to be careful with people's lives, period.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I appreciated the testimony on both sides. I missed Mr. Joachim's because I happened to step out of the room right when he came up, and I wish I had heard that, but I'm not going to ask him to come back. But I'm wondering from your perspective, and you feel strongly about this as do the firefighters, the harm in going through the process. And if you don't like the outcome of the process, say, here's why I disagree with the process. Here's why I don't like the result. I think the assumption of the bill is that they're probably going to require this. At least that's my sense from listening to this, that they're likely to come up with a building code that's going to require residential single-family homes, new construction, have sprinkler systems. Is that a fair assessment? Do you think that it's definitely they're coming out that way, or you think it's an open question? And if you think it's an open question, why avoid them going through the whole process and trying to come up with what their decision is?
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, currently they're anticipating, if they haven't already, considering, this is the Department of Standards and Codes, the 2012 International Building Code, which has in it sprinklers. That's being in the process of being considered now.
And
Senator
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, and your assumption is that they are probably going to adopt that if you don't succeed in your legislation.
Well, whether they do or whether they don't, we have an opportunity to give them some direction in that regard.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, this is
Marty.
More than giving them direction. This is saying you're not going to do it, period. And again, I mean, Senator Ingebrigtsen's question, or what about local governments wanting to do this? You're not letting them do it if they want to. I don't see this as a really easy issue. I mean, I see the fire safety thing is critically important. I mean, if the stuff from the builders says that somebody's study says it would 0.44% would increase one's chances of surviving a hypothetical structure by 0.44% from 99.45 to, with hardwired smoke alarm, only to 99.89%. And just looking at the 3,000 single-family home dwellings per year, if every one of those single-family homes had a hardwired detector in, that 0.44% would mean about 13, 14 lives a year. And we don't have all that, and of course it would be very expensive to retrofit everybody, and we're not going to do that, and so on. But nevertheless, I'd say, one, it's very expensive to do. I'm not disagreeing with you on that. And two, 13 lives a year is a lot of people. That's why I guess I'm one of those who thinks, let them make the ruling, and if you don't like the decision, then come back next year and do it. I mean, I truly have been wrestling with this, but housing partnership coming in and saying, yeah, we're concerned about affordable housing, concern you expressed. I understand that. I just, wonder why it's so urgent we do it now instead of let the process work out.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been kind of writing some numbers down here, and if we took an average of $5,000 per home over a 30-year mortgage, in principle, that's about $166 a year. If you break that down per month, you're talking, what, $10, $12 a month, plus the interest costs for a homeowner when they borrow to be able to include this feature if it were to cost that much. So for me, I don't know. Is that too expensive for the possibility of saving the lives of the family in there? Reasonable people maybe would disagree on that. I mean, Senator Jungbauer's discussion about costs put a lot of questions in my mind, questions which I don't think that this legislative committee process is adequate to answer, which is why they tend to have a much more detailed rulemaking process. And I'm a strong advocate for affordable housing. I served on the MICA board for years, and I've carried homeless legislation and so on, and so that's a big concern of mine. But I think we need a little more information, I do anyway, before I could rule on whether or not this would be appropriate. And I don't think we need to doubt the quality of the construction or the builder's intent or anything like that to reach decisions on this. If we assume builders build the code, I think the question still is, what should the code be? You know, if we took the logic that consumers simply should have the entire choice to make themselves, well, we might as well just throw out the whole building code altogether then. It's the successful stories in the building code that haven't made the headlines, not the mold stuff, which, of course, whatever you attribute the cause to, that made lots of headlines and lots of disputes, but it's the 99% of the code that has worked well that we don't hear about. It doesn't merit newspaper or television coverage. Who knows? This might well turn out to be one of those pieces. It doesn't feel to me like the same kind of an issue for dispute anyway. As a chief author of a lot of bills in the last 4 years, I've gone through the legislative process quite a bit and found that even though I might not like all the changes committee made to my bill along the way, in the end I had to admit in most cases I ended up with a better product on the Senate floor and a better product being signed into law because it had gone through the process than if it had just adopted what I had originally had drafted. So I think that process is important, and I think the rulemaking process is valuable for that reason. I mean, they'll weigh more than we could weigh here. They'll consider more inputs than we could possibly consider here and have more information presented by experts on the whole range, and including those that aren't at the table here, like the insurance industry, which I suspect would like to avoid having to pay the cost of rebuilding some of the homes that do get destroyed by fire. So while it is a balance, I mean, I think we're all struggling here to kind of balance where should government fall on this kind of thing. I think for me the balance comes in at least let the process work its work its way through, and then let's evaluate the outcomes at that point. And if we disagree with the outcomes, we think there wasn't sufficient input, they didn't give enough consideration or weight to this versus that factor, well, we can weigh in at that point as well. But I don't think there's any need to rush on this. And more importantly, I think it's that we as a group don't need to make that judgment here today. We can let the process work, and then if we want to, we can read the hundreds of pages of input that will go into that. And I think that's, frankly, a very conservative approach to take and to the role of government to take, to let the process work its course and then evaluate the outcome and see if it's something that makes sense to us or not. But then at least we'll have had all the inputs, more than we could do here today.
Thank you. Senator Limmer, would you move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that House File Number 460 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
Okay. Senator Limmer moves House File 460 to be passed and moved to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay.
Nay.
The ayes have it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Without any more business at hand, we are adjourned.